Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners. And also joining us is our very own producer, Chris Cervello, a retired United States Navy commander and public affairs officer who is also one of the co-founders of the ProVision Advisors PR firm. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vagha.
Thanks, Vagha.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year, conducted virtually. Chris, you're joining us for the beginning of this conversation because, Byron, I want to hear about the two great notes that you put out. You put out some terrific work all the time, but especially late on Sundays to get people focused on what the top and important issues will be over the coming week. You did a great report on European defense and another, a look ahead at recent corporate earnings and what they mean. A lot has happened since you last joined us. Joe Biden is now the president-elect. Kamala Harris is the vice president-elect. President Trump has said that he is not going to leave office, contesting the validity of the outcome and wants recounts and investigations. We'll see how that turns out. We have also been talking for some time about the fate of Mark Esper, and the president has terminated him with a tweet saying effectively, you have been terminated. Talk to us about what the departure of Dr. Esper means in the broader context of where we are, right? Senate back, House going to be back next week, et cetera. Let's start with Esper's departure and what that means, because obviously that's the breaking news today.
Well, if you think about it from the internals, I mean, not other than the symbolism at all and the drama of it all, the FY22 budget is probably more or less done as far as, the internal mechanics of the Pentagon are concerned. I'm sure there are some final, dots to cross, T's to cross and I's to dot. But, I suppose the next big event will be the OMB passback. And that typically happens around, kind of that period between Thanksgiving and Christmas, maybe New Year's. But the FY22 budget arguably is the Biden administration or the next session of Congress is going to be the ones that are going to have the final say on that. There really aren't many major events, global events that I could see where the Secretary of Defense, his presence would be noteworthy. That I think the next one is probably going to be the Munich Security Conference in February. But again, that's going to be Biden administration. I suppose the one thing that might matter a bit is what's going to happen in the next relief package if, in fact, Congress can get down to this, before the end of 2020 or even the very early part of 2021. There should be appropriations in that for the reimbursable costs that contractors are allowed. That's something that a strong Secretary of Defense could weigh in on. Although if Ellen Lord sticks around, she's really been the point person for a lot of that. And so that's the one thing that I might watch for.
Chris, give us your sense on all of this. Obviously, the president has chosen the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Chris Miller, to be the acting defense secretary. I think many people found that. Some people found it surprising because, as we've discussed on the program, if anybody would be expected to fill in for a fired defense secretary, it should be the deputy defense secretary, Dave Norquist, a highly qualified person who's been serving at the highest ranks of the Pentagon. Chris Miller, Army veteran, did time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and before going into the spec ops job, I think, at the Pentagon, and then over in August to the National Counterterrorism Center. What does this more broadly say? Because I think a lot of folks have been saying that the president was going to go on a firing spree, and Mark Esper was going to be in that first batch.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen our last firing. Just watching Twitter since the news about Secretary Esper broke, and there are quotes from John McEntee, the director of the White House personnel office, who is, according to administration officials and a number of tweets, is saying that, you know, the president has said that if he hears of anyone looking for another job, they will be fired as well. So I mean, not to, you know, add to the palace intrigue, but I think that this is a look inside of where the president's head is and what the next several weeks of what would have been transition are going to be like for those that are trying to see the remainder of this administration through and hand over the reins to the Biden-Harris administration. So I think it's going to be tumultuous at best for those that are still around the president.
I mean, isn't it interesting, guys, that almost every person who has served this administration and tried to serve it admirably and actually execute the president's policies, even if they disagree with them, find themselves rewarded with a bullet.
You and Byron and others on this show have opined correctly just how out of the ordinary all of this is and how unpresidential behavior like this is, to say the least.
Well, Vago, and the one thing that's going to be interesting, I'd be curious, you know, what comes up in the Friday panel. I believe by law, isn't David Norquist supposed to be the next in line? He is the Undersecretary of Defense. So why Norquist wasn't picked for this is also kind of intriguing.
Look, I mean, yes, I think that's a very, very good question. Although the president has the ability to put as acting anybody who he wants in that job, as opposed to.
Yeah, that's certainly what the folks at the White House personnel office are saying. I mean, in response to questions like the one that you and Byron just asked, they're saying that it, as long as it is a person that is Senate approved and is in the job now, because of the Vacancies Act, they can pick whoever they want. And then, you know, under a certain amount of time, they would have to nominate somebody else. The other interesting point is that Miller has not been out of active service for 7 years or more. Now, I don't think that matters for the Vacancies Act, but if he were to be formally nominated, he would need the same type of waiver that Mattis received when he was confirmed. So it's just, it all adds to the swirl that is now going around DC and the Pentagon.
Very, very quickly, I just want to get both of your sense on legacy. Obviously, Dr. Esper is as qualified as any American who served in the role of defense secretary, somebody who'd served in the active guard reserve. I know I get tired of saying this, you know, higher degrees have served in uniform, had served in appointed office, had served at a trade association, had served in industry. So he really brought all of that, you know, was a staffer on the Hill, so brought that perspective as well. Byron, what do you think his legacy is going to be as a longtime observer? And then Chris, want to get your take, given that it was a former Army secretary that became instrumental in trying to drive the growth of the United States Navy. Go ahead, Byron.
Well, yeah, I think just off the top of my head, I think the Knight Court process that was introduced at the Army when he was Secretary of the Army was noteworthy. And then really bringing that to the broader DOD. Clearly, I think one of the other things that I remember for is the embrace of the national defense strategy and great power competition. I mean, he was laser-like focused on that. We could argue if that was, you know, if that was correct to be so intently focused on it, but he drove that message and he drove it hard.
Chris?
It's unfortunate that, you know, his time as Secretary of Defense comes to an end like this, because, I mean, he was a pretty loyal Secretary of Defense, both loyal to those that were serving him in uniform, and he was loyal to the president. I mean, he carried a lot of water for this president and sold a lot of the president's rhetoric. He sold that to the uniformed services, and he did his best to buffer or to act as a buffer in between that same rhetoric and those in uniform. And to be, you know, fired by tweet or terminated by tweet, you know, to quote the president's tweet, is unfortunate. On you know, on the Battle Force 2045. I thought he was a bit out of his depth in trying to grab that as the Secretary of Defense and bring it up to OSD. But I think his attempt was to try to get all of these individual service plans out of their silos and have them, you know, better integrated at the Secretary of Defense and Joint Staff level. So in that regard, I guess it's a plus. But as we said earlier, I mean, all of this is not only a it's not only disrespectful to a guy who served loyally, it's very much unpresidential and more unpresidential activity from a president that I don't think we've heard the last of.
I'll just tag on to that because I think that's a really interesting point that Chris made. You know, as much as there's now speculation that Trump's going to be running in 2024, you kind of have to wonder, you know, the way someone like Esper gets treated in this environment, you know, who's going to serve under that administration? And I think that is a question that people could be pondering in the years to come.
Look, I mean, the president's still got almost 71 million votes, right? I mean, so he's got tremendous support. And I think there are legions of people who will serve, you know, even if there are, you know, more available jobs. I think on the one hand, Dr. Esper will be, you know, sort of criticized for the Lafayette Park picture or for having, you know, saluted to execute decisions. But in fairness, when the White House makes a decision, it's either up to you to execute that decision or to resign. And Dr. Esper did recognize that what happened in Lafayette Park was wrong and has very, very, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but worked very, very hard to try to be the first, apologize for what happened, and then second, work with General Milley to be that buffer between so that you don't have a politicization of the military. And that's kind of the interesting element here in this. Although I have to say, getting fired by the president is, you know, it's a long list at this point of people who've been fired.
It's no longer an exclusive club.
It's no longer that exclusive. And there were folks who, you know, were urging him not to resign. Courtney Kuby did a terrific job with that story last week, saying that he had prepared his resignation letter. And again, I mean, we've been talking about this for many months, that this was likely to happen. But do you see that? You know, does that create any sort of tension? I mean, I just saw Seth Moulton, the Democrat from Massachusetts, a former Marine who's joined us on the program a couple of times, you know, was meeting with Marines in Quantico, and he sort of made that point, you know, urged the president to do nothing that further politicizes the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's too late for that. I'm sure there'll be droves of stories that talk about how this is, you know, the latest in a morale killer for troops in uniform, or you know, has serious impact on civil military relations and whatnot. And some of that is probably true. I mean, I think just like the rest of the country, the folks at the Pentagon are probably at this point ready for the transition to begin.
Byron, any last thoughts?
No, just, you know, like, you know, there'll be a memoir, you know, there's going to be more speculation about, you know, what really happened and how it all went down. So, I think it's something that will reverberate. I absolutely see your point about, you know, the number of people who would readily step up and serve in a second Trump administration. But, you know, I don't know how, you when you see how someone who was qualified the way Esper was qualified, the way he gets treated, again, you have to ask yourself, for the people who are really qualified, you know, is that something that will weigh on their mind? And we'll only know in 2025 if this is even an issue or not.
Going to be very, very interesting to see what happens in the next coming weeks, given that the president will be the president until January the 20th. So quite a lot of time and quite a lot of tweets that will happen between now and then. Chris, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bhaga.
Byron, so let's talk more about key takeaways from your standpoint as you look at the situation and what it all means for U.S. defense.
Well, look, I think the next couple of weeks, really, because we have 71 or 72 days to the inauguration. You know, your show last week with Arnold Pinero and Michael Baer, I think, did a great job just kind of laying out some of the transition issues. I kind of categorize a lot of this as more in the headline risk. I also think the timing of the National Defense Authorization Act and the FY21 appropriations bills it really shouldn't matter to the fundamentals of the companies. If this doesn't get done in December, then it'll get done in January or February, particularly for the appropriation side. I think, you know, there wasn't really a major step function change between FY21 and FY20. So it's news, you know, but I think that's about it. Is it really going to, you know, get anybody to wake up in the morning and fundamentally change their business plan or their budget plan? No. I do think, you know, some of the things that I would watch, however, first and foremost is probably, so how is, what's kind of the messaging going on about another stimulus package? Because I think, you know, the election outcome created, we're going to have divided government, it looks like, again. You know, can something get done in this November, December time period? Or are you going to see the very stark partisan divide that meant nothing could get done? And kind of related to that, I'd also watch how this Georgia, the Georgia Senate election is going to shape up too, because that's really going to determine the balance of control in the Senate. And so, you know, these are more posture positioning issues that I think will have ramifications as we really start to think about what is 2021 going to look like, and 2022 for that matter, and far as defense spending and broader policy issues that will bear on defense are going to play through.
We're going to talk a little bit more about this on the Friday roundtable in terms of what the political dynamics are. But there is a big debate in Washington going on. There are some who are saying that Mitch McConnell will now be the voice of reason. As a Republican friend of mine put it, you know, that's a relative thing, given how insane from his standpoint the caucus has become. But at the end of the day, Mitch McConnell also has been Dr. No, Byron, as you know. And there's this sense that if he didn't allow any legislation to succeed from President Obama, he's unlikely to do that with President Biden. Is there any sense, and why should there be any expectation, that Mitch McConnell is going to be a constructive and positive force when, in fact, from a Republican standpoint, they didn't lose the Senate, the presidential race was pretty close, and they gained seats in the House?
The gating factor is really going to be how people think about the midterm election in 2022. And I mean, that's just the basic fundamental fact is, okay, 2020 election is now more or less over. You know, there are more Republican senators coming up for reelection in the 2022 midterm. We're back to the same dynamic. If it's a 51-49 type split in the GOP majority in the Senate, you know, if nothing happens, and that's the perception that the GOP controlled Senate is being obstructionist to getting some of these things done, they run the risk of losing more ground in the midterm election. And then, you know, then we're all going to be talking about the 2024 election. But that would be the only thing that I think, you know, do you want to fight your battles now? Or do you, you know, and try and obstruct anything from happening in 2022? Or do you really save your powder and hope that you can make it through 2022 and then, you know, position the GOP for the 2024 election? And that's going to be an interesting dynamic to see that play through.
Obviously, and the notion of healing the nation has to be shared by both parties if you're going to do any healing. That obviously the sting of the loss is very fresh for Trump voters at the end of the day, who are rejecting any notion that even the election was legitimate. So I think the president's messaging and Republican messaging overall on this has proven to be relatively successful. Go ahead, if you.
But I think, you know, I think the difference here is, and particularly with the news today on the Pfizer vaccine, you know, you can really have a pretty strong economy in the back half of 2021 and into 2022 if the pandemic really does abate. And we kind of just get back to a more normal way of living our lives. And that could be a pretty powerful tailwind for the Democrats going into the midterm elections. And the other point that I'd make is, you know, there's still a couple of pretty interesting Supreme Court cases that'll be coming up on, you know, particularly on healthcare. So I just think, you know, the old pattern of kind of obstructing or blocking anything from happening, that can really blow up in your face if people see a pretty good economy and, oh, by the way, some Supreme Court decisions that maybe create more angst about things like healthcare. And if the Senate majority tries to block any ability to address that, that could really blow up in their face.
So, Byron, you also took, you're a keen observer of earnings. Obviously, you've been in the industry for 3.5 decades. What did these earnings reports from the leading companies, as well as some of the smaller companies, both domestically and abroad, tell you?
I think, I do this kind of every quarter. You finally just go through all the earnings reports, both for the large defense primes, but also try and, pull out some of the divisions of other companies that, they may be covered, but they're typically not part of the day-to-day defense dialogue. So KBR or Curtis Wright, for example, are two that may come to mind. I think my three takeaways are operating margins were stable. Actually, they were up a little bit from the last two quarters, but that was kind of a reflection of the absence of charges at Huntington Ingalls and Boeing on the KC-46 program. There was a minor charge, but, that was looking a little bit better. Management's generally upbeat, but they don't have any more visibility about what exactly a Biden administration will mean. I think they're all generally positive on the outlook, but I still personally think there's going to be a lot more trade-off that needs to take place between modernization, readiness, and personnel, and that's going to be some challenging times for the sector. And then the other point I thought was interesting was just how share buybacks had really fallen off here. There were a couple that stepped it up again in the September quarter, but the flip of that was if you looked at some of the large primes, they've had a build in their cash positions as they have not spent as much money repurchasing stock. And so it kind of gets into this, wow, these guys are going to have a fair amount of dry powder. So when Lockheed Martin starts talking about doing acquisitions again, you can take that string and draw it through the other contractors as well. Sure, they could just spend it on buying back stock or paying down debt, but it's just going to be an interesting setup for 2021 is, okay, what are you going to do with this cash that you've built up? And it certainly does not suggest that there's been a lot of duress in the sector. They've really navigated COVID-19 very well with a lot of help from the Department of Defense.
Do you sense that we're on the cusp? I mean, everybody always, asks, especially at the start of a new administration and in moments like this, when the updraft has certainly, right, the uptick in defense spending is flattening and is likely to face some downward pressure. Do you think that we're on the cusp of any meaningful consolidation of the industry?
I cannot imagine that a Biden administration would want to see further consolidation among the top five or six contractors in this industry. I mean, I think, it's the old, so you're going to get more innovation and cost control by having a more diverse set of contractors. And the idea that, consolidation is going to lead to significant cost savings to the Department of Defense, I just don't think you can point to that based on at least where weapon systems costs have headed. So I'm skeptical. It's not to say that you won't see more consolidation in the services sector. That's been pretty fragmented. And I think you will see some more portfolio shaping among the primes, but the idea that you're going to get a, Northrop Boeing merger or a General Dynamics Lockheed Martin merger, forget it.
Do you sense that they will do things to expand the contractor base and bring some new innovative companies in? And how do you do that, right? I mean, we've had that to a degree over the past decade or so with Palantir and Amazon, Microsoft playing a bigger role. At the end of the day, do you see a more dramatic change? I should have put Google in there.
Yeah, as well. I think, yes. I mean, I think what I'm hearing from a lot of the smaller kind of venture-backed firms is they really need to have lanes created for them where they can scale. So they just don't have to go to the large cap primes to sell to the Department of Defense, but that they can find ways that they could grow to a billion or more in sales. And so I think, you know, you'd have to ask yourself, what would happen if SpaceX said, okay, we've got this really neat rocket and we're going to sell it through Boeing and Lockheed Martin. I mean, that would have never happened. So I think this idea that the primes are going to be gatekeepers and they're the ones who are going to filter out who can play in defense and who can't play in defense, that might be one of the more significant things that could happen. Again, we really have to see who Biden puts in as DOD leadership. And, you know, we're getting into the a little bit more into the weeds on this, but I think that is going to be a powerful thrust. And I think the other fact of the Biden administration that's going to carry through is, you know, that we're not going to slack off on this competition with China. So the idea that you can engage a broader set of the U.S. economy, tech companies, and even companies like General Motors in addressing security needs, I think that's going to go a long way in this administration.
Let me take you to your European report, which was absolutely fascinating, sort of quantifying not only the spending increases, year-by-year breakdowns, as well as on modernization priorities. I mean, it's really an extraordinary piece of work that you did, and also some very, very thought-provoking questions that you're framing. Give us some of the key takeaways from that piece.
Yeah, I'm never going to claim to be as expert on this subject as like Sasha Tusha is, who's also on your show. So I'm more of a tourist than a resident expert. But
Byron, you've done a pretty credible job.
Well, you know,
if I can use a sailing analogy, right? You were beam reaching across it, and you did a pretty good job.
I know. Well, I didn't hit any of the marks or buoys or foul anybody else's. But I think the point that I wanted to make on it, I started that report with the idea that, hey, there's a possibility that Trump could win the re-election and that you really have to start thinking very differently about the U.S. and NATO. But I still think a lot of the ground truths hold that Europe has to be looking at the United States as, okay, this election, you know, you kind of avoid that, hey, the U.S. is going to get out of NATO scenario in a second Trump term. But that's not to say that that doesn't reemerge back in 2024 beyond. And I think there's probably even a sense or sentiment that, you know, the Biden administration has really got to focus on a domestic agenda in its first 2 years. So I absolutely don't see a Biden administration backing off the push for Europe to spend more on its security, to cooperate more on common security objectives. And the interesting thing for me, you know, mapping this out was, first, you know, there aren't a whole lot of major new open opportunities for U.S. contractors. You know, there's fighter competition in Switzerland and Finland are probably the two larger ones. And the other thing is just the real profound difference in how the European sector is structured compared to the U.S. Structure. You've got a lot more companies in Europe that are multi-sector. You know, they address commercial aerospace as well as defense, or in the case of Rheinmetall, they address the automotive sector as well as defense. And the other part is there aren't a lot of real strong pure plays. You have to get into companies like Kinetic or Hensoldt that have the vast majority of their sales from either the UK or the continent for defense. So, you know, they're more state-owned or private companies like Navantia in Spain or Diehl in Germany, Rohde & Schwarz, you know, that don't always end up on people's radar screens when they think about that sector.
Assuming that Joe Biden is inaugurated and Donald Trump returns to private life, he still has an enormous megaphone. He's still got more than 70 million votes and has very, very ardent and passionate supporters, including in the Republican Party. At the end of the day, Byron, have you calculated the impact that he could have on any and all of these issues, even when he's not in office, including Republican views toward Europe and European allies, on whom he was extraordinarily tough? And there are some people who give him credit for, you know, that pressure driving an increase in defense spending. At the end of the day, have you factored in the role that he plays even when he's not in office? on national security and international relations?
Well, I mean, my starting premise is it's going to be a reduced role. He's not going to have the platform of the presidency. That when the president speaks, that's usually, you know, top of news in any given day. So I tend to think that it will be the diminished perspective. And I think the other point here, Vago, is, you know, this idea that he's going to be the nominee for 2024. I mean, I think he'll probably be in his mid to late 70s in that time period. There are going to be a lot of younger Republicans who are going to say, hey, wait a second, what about me? So I'm not sure. I'm just curious, like, how this will play through in the next 2 to 3 years. You know, if you're in your 50s and up and coming GOP congressman or some of the younger senators, you know, do you try and steal his mantle too? Now, it's not to say that some of the values and belief that Trump has embraced go to the wayside. It could be a different personality, but I think maybe to your point, you know, there's been a little bit of a precedent established. And if I were a European Ministry of Defense, I would think a little bit harder about the risks that could come roaring back in 2025.
Let me take you to some of the modernization specifics. You did, as I mentioned, a meticulous job looking at air, land, sea modernization programs, nuclear modernization. France, obviously, it's a priority. Same for Britain and obviously even for the United States. But one of the points you made is the things are just simply not being replaced one for one, right? I mean, this has been a very, very long running trend. But if you look at it, Belgium, for example, as you broke down, is going from 54 F-16s down to 34 F-35s. What impact does all of this have? Because at the end of the day, you can make the case that these platforms are more capable. But what we found in Iraq and in Afghanistan is, especially for these smaller countries, it was leveraging the entire air force of a couple of dozen airplanes to make sure that you can have a handful downstream in Iraq or Afghanistan. What are the impacts and the implications of all of this sort of minimal,
well,
viable
the problem,
defense approach?
You know, and this is what's kind of two thoughts here. You know, you're fewer assets, you're going to be more careful in how you employ them. And if you start taking losses, and this, you know, is something else that I think isn't always appreciated about how some of these conventional conflicts could actually play out, you know, you start seeing attrition rates that are pretty robust. It may make you think twice about A, sustaining operations, or B, getting engaged in them in the first place. The other thing that I haven't really seen yet from Europe, and this may be more the tourist perspective as opposed to the resident expert's perspective, but the kind of discussion around like the Navy Battle Force 2045, where there's a recognition that, hey, you can use a lot more autonomous systems, the loyal wingman concept. Now, I know that's both part of Tempest and the SCAF programs in the UK and France, Germany, but other systems, naval systems, ground combat systems. And so it's going to be interesting to see if Europe starts adjusting to that basis that, look, if you're not replacing your manned platforms on a one-for-one basis, you better start figuring out how to get other capacity in there to weather, you know, what could be a pretty ugly storm you sail into or fly into or drive into.
And as we wrap up, what should folks be paying attention to over the coming week?
There are a lot of think tank events that are going to be on the election's aftermath, particularly foreign policy, both in Washington, D.C. and London. This is an investor event, but I think on Thursday, BAE Systems is going to be doing a review of their defense programs and outlook. So it'll be good to hear from them, because I frankly think and wish that a lot of these contractors would spend more time really talking about what they do for a living, as opposed to just, you know, how much cash they're generating and what they're going to do with that cash.
Byron, thanks very much for joining us. Looking forward to having you on Friday.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.